And among my tactics are to make a lot of analogies, sometimes to things like classical music. Yes, that's right. I will often say, you know, his style of play is more like Tchaikovsky, whereas the other guy is more like Brahms. So I make a lot of analogies, and I, you know, try to write vividly, and I try to link sports to things outside the sports world so people will care about it if they don't think they inherently do.
So in terms of March Madness, let's actually get into kind of the nitty-gritty of it right now.
All right.
We're here at the University of Illinois. A lot of people didn't think that the team would make it into the March Madness tournament, at least until the last couple of weeks. I mean, there's no real science to how teams get in. I mean, why would a team like Illinois, whose offense and defense are not in the top 100, how did they get into the tournament?
They did well in the beginning of the year, is the short answer. And they beat Gonzaga, which is a number one seed, the only team to beat Gonzaga on their home court. And I think that the committee who makes these selections looks at the totality of what they do. And even though Illinois started the Big Ten season, I think, 2-7, and were just kind of lost in the middle of the season, they righted the ship. And they righted it enough to get a 7 seed, which isn't a team that just eked its way into the tournament, which is a team, the committee is saying, that really deserves to be there. Although I think a lot of people have looked at how Illinois has played as of late and are saying, maybe they'll lose in the first round.
Yeah, they're playing Colorado, who seem like it seems kind of fashionable to pick Colorado as a team that might be a bit of a sleeper.
That's true, although the Illinois basketball history is a lot better than the Colorado basketball history. I just think that Illinois loves to jack up those three-pointers, but they're just not so good at making those three-pointers. So the whole game really can depend on if they get a little bit hot, Illinois does, and hits a bunch of their threes more than they usually hit, because we know they're going to take them, and it all depends if they can make them.
Let's look at sort of the Big Ten in this tournament. I mean, what do you think are the chances of a Big Ten team going far, including Illinois?
Yeah, I think probably not Illinois, but there are a couple of other really live teams. The Big Ten was weird this year. How could you definitively make the case that one team is so much better? I mean, the tournament selection committee, by making Indiana number one seed or saying this is the best team, and yeah, they've been up there, but you know, they have their losses in the Big Ten. Specifically, it seems like Wisconsin just owns Indiana. Wisconsin's a 5 seed. They're playing in the same bracket as Gonzaga, which is kind of a weak number one seed. I mean, they haven't played a big schedule, a good schedule out of conference. Gonzaga hasn't. So maybe Wisconsin could beat them. Tom Izzo's Michigan State team, that's just about the best coach in the country, and they're, of course, a great team. So among the teams I just mentioned, and maybe you want to throw in Ohio State also, I would say there's even a likelihood that at least one Big Ten team will make the Final Four.
There was a lot of, I'd say, actual anger in Indiana this week because the Hoosiers were picked as number one in the Big East, but they were not picked number one overall. And I guess the hope was if they got picked number one overall, they might be able to play their home games in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Was that a justified rage, or is Indiana just kind of being upset for the sake of being upset about basketball?
Right. They couldn't play their games and, you know, walk to work every day. Here's the thing. They didn't win their conference tournament, did they? And Louisville did win their conference tournament. There are consequences to that sort of thing. If you compare them head-to-head over the whole season, maybe Indiana is the better team. But the committee, I think rightly so, wants to give a reward for winning the conference tournament. And the Indiana people who are upset about this, I mean, every team in the country would trade places with Indiana except one in terms of the seeding. You play a good regular season, and they certainly did, but it wasn't flawless. It wasn't nearly flawless. They have a half dozen or so losses on their ledger, and so that, to me, doesn't argue for it. Therefore, we deserve the easiest path to the Final Four. They still have a number one seed.
So people are putting their brackets together if they haven't already put their brackets together. And I'm sure you saw this on NPR a couple days ago. They actually covered a class being offered at, I believe it's the University of Cincinnati, in bracketology.
Yeah.
Where these statisticians are getting together and they're trying to essentially engineer the, you know, statistically perfect bracket. That seems like a giant, silly waste of time. Am I wrong?
I guess the chair in phrenology, funding for that, dried up. So they went to bracketology. First of all, bracketology is the word that people use when they talk about the fellows who predict which teams are going to be in the tournament. So Joe Lunardi is ESPN's bracketologist. Joe Lunardi is the bracketologist. Well, he and everyone else was paying attention. There was only one questionable team. It was either going to be Tennessee or Middle Tennessee State. He had a rather easy job. And then when it comes to seedings, I don't think it's the most vital thing in the world. I mean, it's okay as entertainment, but it probably should not be where the emphasis of higher education. Maybe this is the lowest of higher education.
It's interesting because it seems like the safest thing to do, obviously, is to pick, you know, for the final four, pick the top seeds in each one.
Some years, there's, I think, only been one year where it's all number one seeds. And it does seem like there are a whole lot of upsets. But then when you look at the teams that make the final four, you know, they're number one, two, and three seeds. But I will say this. If you look at the composition of the best teams in basketball, you know, by definition, the top 10 teams are going to be the best teams. But this year's top 20 is far weaker than previous year's top 20. And a statistician by the name of Ken Pomeroy has nice charts where he kind of lays over different years' top 20s. And what this year is looking like is a year with a lot of upsets. Because someone's got to be a number three seed, someone's got to be a number four seed, but those teams are remarkably weaker. And in fact, I think a lot of the advanced statisticians don't hold some of the teams that have gotten top seeds in very high regard. The Cognoscenti, the basketball Cognoscenti, think teams like Florida, which is a number three seed, might be one of the best teams in the country. And I think they look at Miami, which is a number two seed, as something like the 15th best seed in the country. So there is a lot of opportunity for a lot of surprising teams. You just got to pick the right surprising teams.
I mean, it seems like, okay, the safe thing to do is obviously to pick the top seeds. And you probably won't embarrass yourself too badly if you're doing that in a bracket. But you also won't have all that much invested, right? Like, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's so obvious to pick those. Isn't there a lot more drama if you're going to pick a couple of places like Middle Tennessee?
Well, I think you want to win. Here's what I would advise. It depends on the size of the pool. It depends on how many people you're competing against. And if you're in a large pool with 100 people picking brackets, you have to go a little bit off the board. You have to go away from the chalk. But if you're doing it among a dozen friends, I think maybe conservatism should be the wisest path.
Do you pick a bracket every year, Mike?
I pick several brackets every year.
Do you pick several different brackets?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Do you have any confidence in those?
Yeah, sure, I usually do all right. I mean, if you add up all my seven brackets, I get like four games right in all of them.
I don't know if you saw this yesterday, but somebody put out basically a March Madness for public radio shows. Did you see this post from KPCC?
I did, but some of my favorite shows weren't on it, and then some other shows that were, and then they like, I think they had on the media against All Things Considered. Come on, those are juggernauts. How are they meeting in the first round?
Do you have any picks in the public radio March Madness this year? Any sleepers?
My pal Jesse Thorne's show Bullseye is up against Fresh Air, which is a tough draw. I mean, there's no better interviewer than Terry Gross in public radio. But I think Bullseye is getting trounced. Check it and him out. And I can't pick against All Things Considered or Morning Edition. Those are the shows that I'm on. And I don't even know if Thistle and Shamrock is in that March Madness pool. I thought they could have pulled the upset. I thought Thistle and Shamrock, you know, now that Thistle and Shamrock are on the same page, when they weren't really sharing the ball, when Thistle and Shamrock would go to the different sides of the locker room, things weren't working out. But now that they're all gelling, I think that I thought they had a chance. But I guess they're going to the public radio NIT.
I guess I've been telling people my sleeper pick is the Splendid Table. I don't think anyone sees it coming, but it seems to be doing pretty well in its first round.
You know, they're out of shape. I hate to say. When they get late in the game, they're going to be sucking wind to spawn the table.
Mike Pesca is the sports reporter for NPR.
You're welcome. Thank you.
To see the NCAA bracket as well as the public radio March Madness bracket, visit us online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Chris Berube. You're listening to WILL.
WILL programming is made possible by the U of I Center on Health, Aging, and Disability, presenting a symposium on aging and loneliness, Thursday, March 28th, from noon to 4 p.m. at the I Hotel. This event is free and open to the public. Registration information is available at 333-4965.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 21st of March, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet Nizar Kabbani, born in Damascus, 1923. His mother was illiterate, sold her jewelry to raise money to publish his first collection, Childhood of a Bosom, 1948. He went on to become the most popular poet writing in Arabic and to publish more than 20 books of poetry, much of it influenced by the tragic deaths of two women he loved. His older sister, who, when he was 15, committed suicide rather than be forced into marriage with a man she did not love. And many years later, in 1981, his second wife, an Iraqi woman, died during the Lebanese Civil War when the Iraqi embassy was bombed. Kobani was grief-stricken at the loss of his wife, frustrated with the political and cultural climate of the Arab world, and he lived in Europe for the rest of his life. Nizar Kobani, who wrote, "I knew when I said I love you that I was inventing a new alphabet for a city where no one could read, that I was saying my poems in an empty theater and pouring my wine for those who could not taste it." It was on this day in 1965 that Martin Luther King Jr. led the Civil Rights March from Selma, Alabama, to Montgomery to protest the fact that black voters could not vote in Alabama. They had attempted the march twice before earlier in the month. The first time they'd been badly beaten by state troopers, the second time they were ordered to turn back, and this time under court order they were allowed to proceed. And by the time they reached the state capitol in Montgomery, there were 25,000 marchers. It's the birthday of Johann Sebastian Bach, born in Eisenach, Germany, 1685. Came from a musical family. As a teenager, he was an accomplished organist. He worked in various churches, but he could be difficult to get along with. In one post, he criticized the choir, took prolonged absences from his job, and once he got in a fight with a bassoonist and called the bassoonist something you could translate as a bassoonist breaking wind after eating a green onion. He took a leave of absence from his job in the town of Arnstadt so he could go to visit the composer Dietrich Buxtehude, who liked Bach, and Bach could have taken over Buxtehude's position, but by tradition he would have had to marry Buxtehude's daughter, and he decided not to do that and went back to Arnstadt, where the church council held a meeting and complained that Bach was accompanying the hymns with surprising variations and irrelevant ornaments which obliterate the melody and confuse the congregation. And not much later, he left Arnstadt, went on to Leipzig, and a distinguished career as a composer and organist and a great champion of German and sacred music. Here's a poem for today by Tom Clark, "Every Day." Awake, the mind's hopeless, so at 5:45 I rise and run 2 or 3 miles.